Welcome to the USEA official podcast and a bonus episode for you listeners. So a couple of months ago, myself, Nicole Brown and Sam Watson, the Irish international event rider, sat down on the Echo Ratings eventing podcast to talk to the legendary course designer that is Ian Stark. He was himself a top level event rider. Now he designs at the very highest level of the sport for cross country, including at Fairhill, the new five star in the US, which unfortunately, while at the time of recording was very much still on the cards for 2020, is now postponed until 2021, another victim of COVID-19. But we hope you enjoy this really special insight into cross-country design and just what goes through the course designer's mind when they are building some of the biggest and best tracks in the world. We hope you enjoy this very special show and we hope you find it useful. You're listening to the Echo Ratings Eventing Podcast, the show with a lighthearted look at the eventing world, all of the big event previews, reviews and special guests, and of course, backed up with all of the key Echo Rating stats. Welcome to the Echo Ratings Eventing Podcast. Welcome to the Echo Ratings Eventing Podcast. And a new episode, which is a pretty special episode for you listeners. It's one that we have thought about doing for a little while, and the opportunity has arisen to get a man on the show that we are very much looking forward to grilling. Sam is with me. Sam, this is a topic that you, I know, have a massive amount of interest in as well.
I love it. I love it. I love riding courses, but I've been fascinated actually since Echo Ratings got involved with doing a bit of risk management. I've been fascinated with the thought level that goes into course design. These guys, I'm not actually joking about this, but the level of engineering and physics and their understanding of all different types of dynamics that I hadn't really considered is amazing. So listening to some of the discussions that go on around course design, and I think we've got one of the best, and I say that for a reason, in that he sort of brings all of those attributes that he was famous for as a rider and, you know, says, go on, see if you can do it as well. I've really enjoyed riding around some of his courses. So looking forward to chatting to the man himself.
It's going to be really, really good, actually. And I find course design, I look at it as a bit of a science because there is so much more to it than perhaps people initially realise. So we're hopefully going to dig beneath the surface a little bit. And we have a man with us who many of you will know, either as a rider, as a course designer, as a commentator, whichever of those hats he wears them brilliantly. He is a former European champion. He has medaled at Europeans, Worlds and Olympics. And he is now one of the best course designers in the world. Welcome to the show, Ian Stark.
Thank you. I'm kind of scared now with all that introduction.
Don't worry, we're not going to give you a science lesson. Your entire career is probably a show in itself, because that's remarkable. But we want to focus on the course design aspect, because you retired from top level competition in 2007, but you took up course designing, or started your career in course designing, a couple of years prior to that. 2005, I think it was, back at Chatsworth. Is that right?
I believe you. I knew it was around there somewhere, but I couldn't have given you an exact date. But it did start at Chatsworth, and it was actually Mike Etherington Smith who designed the course there and was the event director. And the Duchess of Devonshire, they came to me and said, we thought you should have a go at designing the novice track. And I said, well, I'd never really considered designing, but I thought, well, I'll give it a go and see how it works out. But I said to them right from the beginning, you know, if I'm seriously bad, just tell me and I'll go away and do something else. But it turned out that I rather enjoyed it and was lucky enough to make another career out of it.
Did you immediately love it to build a course that previously you'd always jumped them? Was there a different sort of thrill in building something for other people?
I think at the beginning, I think if you look at my record, maybe not so much at Chatsworth, because that's sort of one of the best standard for novice eventing, but some of the other courses that I did were the low levels I was doing, and I kind of always felt that I wanted to ride miniature badminton, you know, so to get my horses used to the technical difficulty of the big track. And so I produced some of these tracks that I thought were interesting, and I think I was top of the hit parade for falls and runouts and softs and all the levels I was doing at these low levels, all the competitions. And you know, when I got statistics from British Eventing at the end of the day, I thought, this isn't really working. And I'd, certainly there was a lot of people seemed to be leaving their saddles, but and I think it was just me getting overly excited at the beginning, and I've had, you know, time to think about it, and you sort of, you work out a level, or you work out a standard, and you try and stick to that standard, and it's got to be at the correct level for the competition.
And actually, you went from novices at Chatsworth in 2005 to designing the Europeans at Blair in 2015. So 10 years took you from sort of your first attempt to at course design up to a European championship level. Just if you aren't familiar, I should say as well, that the courses that you have designed, Tattersalls, Chatsworth, Carolina over in the States, at Blair Castle, the list goes on. There's lots of them. And hopefully at some point, we hope this year, the new five-star at Fairhill as well over in the States. So it has grown massively in the space of 15 years, absolutely.
Well, I was going to ask, is it intimidating when you first started? Did you, like, at what point do you think you comfortably transitioned from Ian Stark five-star winner to Ian Stark course designer? When did you consider yourself, okay, I've got this, I'm comfortable now? How long did that take?
If I'm brutally honest, I was never overly intimidated by it. When you're designing, you go out there and you're on the course on your own and you're planning it. And so I loved that. That was me and my element, just going out and coming up with ideas and new fences and different terrain and all the rest of it. But the novice level, you know, I got a bit too excited at the beginning. And I think I started to overthink everything and tried to keep it intense enough. And I think it took probably when I started doing the sort of advanced level designing and the international stuff, it probably took me a good 4 or 5 years, not consciously aware that I was settling into it. But when I look back at it, I realized that I was pretty intense at the beginning and I started to get into a swing and begin to enjoy it more. I think when I say enjoy, I enjoyed the designing. I'm still terrified when the riders go out on my course. That is one of the most difficult things, because I always reckon as a competitor, you know, you get what I always call the Saturday morning stomach, which is, you know, your nerves are in a knot in your stomach when you're going to ride the sort of badmintons and burlies of this world. And once you get on the horse, the nerves go away and you concentrate and you focus. When you're designing it, you don't get on the horse. So you're really in that knot until the last horse of the day is finished. And that's still something I find quite difficult to handle. The actual designing is the fun part. The competition is the scary part for me.
Interesting.
I can totally understand why, actually, because I sometimes think that it's harder for people to watch. Like you say, when you're riding, you get on, you do your job. And actually, all you can do when you're designing it and it comes to that cross country day is watch. Like, literally, you can't change anything at that point unless there's decisions to be made about taking fences out and weather and all of those things. But ultimately, your course is there to be jumped. And it's the balance of making sure everybody comes home safely and also making sure that you've set an appropriate test for whatever competition that you are building for. So I can totally appreciate that it would be very nerve-wracking. I think I saw you actually on Cross Country Morning in Carolina last year, and I seem to remember us having a bit of a chat about this, and I sort of thought, no, stop talking to the poor man, leave him alone, give him some peace and quiet. Let's go back to how you design a course, because obviously there are so many courses that you might come in and have a blank canvas, like with the new five-star at Fairhill, perhaps, or you might take over from somebody else that whereby the sort of the major infrastructure is there to start with. How do you actually plan? How far in advance would you take that role on, and how do you start the initial planning process?
Well, you usually Normally I'm offered the course of design more than a year before I take it over. So I get a chance to go and watch the competition and the course as it is, if it's an existing event, with the previous designer. So I get a feel for the flow and how it's working and what I start to look at and think, well, I might not want that, but I might want something over there in this different bit of ground. And I think if you're taking over a course from someone else, you want to stamp it immediately as your course and the feel and the flow that you're looking for. But you can't do everything in one go. I mean, you'd bankrupt any event if you did that. So I reckon it takes you 3 years to get the course round to how you really want it if you're taking over from someone else. When it's like the Fair Hill this five star that I'm doing, it is a new site at Fair Hill. I mean, Fair Hill's been going for a considerable number of years, but it's a new site in the parkland, and so it's a grass site. It's, there's nothing there, and I'm able to plan everything I want from the start. So what I've done is I walked around the estate quite a lot and picked out the areas that I thought I wanted the feature fences, you know, the water, the coffin, any sunken road type thing, anything like that. And then I try and put the flow in so that you start in the right place and you get these combinations at the right place on the course. And then once I've done it, I put it all on paper and then I study it to make sure I've not got the intensity of combinations in too close together, or you've not got too many gallop fences one after the other. So you have to make sure that that you're comfortable with it all. And at the end of the day, as I've said, the riders are going to have to go out there and jump it. I mean, once you've designed it, you've got your technical delegate comes in and they can make you change things. And then you've got the ground jury at the event and they can be quite influential. And then the riders have their own say as well. So, there's a sort of peer pressure and safety mechanism there for in case I get carried away and get something completely wrong. But I love this idea of having a new site and being able to do exactly what I want. And then what happens is I then plan it and I go back again and again and again, and I watch them building the combinations and landscaping the ground. And then I start to panic that maybe I've got too tough, or maybe I've not got tough enough. And so then you stress, well, I stress and I worry a lot. And I'm frequently lying in bed, much to my wife's annoyance, and tossing and turning. And I regularly waking up in the middle of the night thinking about courses. And if I'm panicking about a fence in the middle of the night, then I change it. Even if it's a Friday night of the cross country, before the cross country, I have been known to get the builders out there at 4 o'clock in the morning. If I think something is bugging me and I'm not confident about it, then I go out and tweak a fence at 4 o'clock in the morning. The builders don't like it, but I feel a lot better by the start of the competition.
So do we, as long as you've not made it harder. we've probably given you a nudge on the Thursday and the Wednesday.
It's never gone harder. I always back off. And sometimes, sometimes I get bold and think, yeah, this is it. And it just needs a little tweaking, maybe a bit of brush lower. Or and there was one year at Bramham, and it was about the second or third year I did Bramham, and I'd had the coffin there for this, I think it was the third year. And I got a little bit braver with the rail into the coffin. And because we take all the fences away because at Bramham they've got the music festival in August. So we have to remove all the fences and rebuild them. So we put the rails back in exactly the same place. I think it was a little bit higher. And the riders were quite a lot of them saying to me, this is a bit tougher. And I said, no, it's exactly the same. And on the Friday night, I began to panic and think, actually, I think it is about almost 2 inches higher than it was the year before. Not that I'd measured it, but it just in my head, I was convinced it was a bit higher. So I got the boys out at 4 a.m. and we lowered it 2 inches. And it was a frangible fence, so it's quite a lot of work. And at the end of the day, William Fox Fitz spoke to me about the course, and he said, the coffin rode better than I expected. And I started to laugh, and And he said to me, what? And I said, no, I can't tell you. I can't really say. And he said, yeah, no, it's fine. It's okay. Just say. And I said, well, I had the boys out in the middle of the night lowering the fence. And he said, you know, I walked it at 7 o'clock or 7:30 that morning. He said, I began to think I was getting a bit brave. He said, I thought it was easier. So he had noticed, but that was just me sort of slightly bottling it at the last minute.
I think that's probably, you have to go with your gut though, don't you? It's like riding to a degree. Sometimes you have to sort of react to what is happening, and you have to react to actually that. If you feel something, then there's generally a reason for it.
Exactly. And whenever I do wake up and I'm thinking about a particular fence on a course, then I go and I just change it completely or tweak it. Because I've got to be comfortable myself. The riders, I'm asking the riders to go out there and the horses to jump fences, that I've got to be happy and confident that they're correct. My biggest dread in the world is to trick a horse or them not to be able to read or understand the question. I don't mind if the riders find it difficult. The riders have got to work it out. And if they're not happy or brave, or for whatever reason, if the horse has been inexperienced, then, you know, there's usually, for a tough course, a tough fence, there's usually an alternative. So the riders have a choice. But I always dread the horses not understanding my fences. And I do normally lie in bed awake. Chances are I do nothing in bed but think about cross-country courses. Other things happen.
I mean, we don't need to go down that route.
I go over the course and I imagine that I'm riding the fences and what feeling I'm looking for from the horse and how the horse is going to react and the shape it's going to make. And so if I'm confident with that when I'm thinking about it and planning it, then I'm happy to present it to the riders.
Ian, do you have an objective in your mind and when you're building a course? What I think is the hardest thing is you are trying to get that good feeling from you want everyone to enjoy the course, the horses to enjoy the course, to be able to understand it. But you've got to push the comfort zone too. You've got to push us out of our comfort zone, particularly at the higher levels. You know, you've got to ask those questions. So, you know, what way do you approach it? I actually personally love hearing you. It's very much, you can hear the horseman coming through, and I think that's really important. And we appreciate that because that's generally the best way to go. But then do you battle with that sort of saying, oh, I've got to, you know, open the door here, or I've got to ask questions somehow. And what are you thinking is your ideal result at the end of the day?
I suppose I'd battle with it once I've built, usually once I've planned and mostly built the fences. And talking about Carolina Horse Park in North Carolina in America, I work with Tyson Rementer there. He builds for me. And he said that he always, when asked for a question, he'd stick a fence up and he would put it too high and, you know, ready to lower it. He would just have it set. And I would say, this is perfect height and that's good. And it kind of shocked him. And he said, now he realizes that, you know, he thought he was getting carried away building the big fences, but he realizes I'm looking for that because the riders are so good nowadays and the horses are so well trained. So you've got to be brave enough and bold enough to keep the height and the dimensions of the fences. And again, as long as the horses understand them, then I think you have to get a bit brave because it's not only that competition that matters. Up until now, these competitions are being, you know, I mean, I've always been doing the old three-star, the four-star. It's a competition in its own right, and it's important, but it's a stepping stone to the five-star. And I dread horses and riders galloping around the four-star now that's too easy and going to a five-star and having a disastrous time. I'd much rather they strove to get the standard right and their abilities and their training and established. By the time they go to the five-star, they're ready. Horses are ready and riders are ready. Sorry, I feel like that's kind of waffling. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think really, because I personally, I think you can still learn even if you even if you've jumped that bigger course at 4-star that has just pushed that little bit out of your comfort zone, you've either risen to the challenge and done it well, in which case, you know, that's brilliant, I've achieved something, or you've learned to, you've made a mistake that you can then go and learn from, you know, you and the horse learn from, and if you don't learn from it, you're not ready for the next level. Whereas yeah. if it's a little bit undercooked, you haven't had anything to step up to, you've probably not achieved as much and you've not really progressed, and if you miss, you know, there's not as much to learn either. So I think that makes an awful lot of sense.
And I think it is very easy for people to get to 5-star. No, not very easy, but you know what I mean, literally speaking. They can qualify for a 5-star, but a lot of the horses are never going to be up for it, and some of the riders aren't necessarily going to be up for it, and I think you have to realize that, you know, not every horse is going to do 5-star. It is the exceptional horse. And you know, I'd much rather people found out that their horse or they themselves are not ready and take another year and, you know, do another few 4-stars rather than, oh, I'm qualified for 5-star, let's go. And the other thing that thinking about designing, and I think I was quite vocal at Bramham last year, because I'm around at the events and I'm happy to walk the course with riders if they want. And very few of the riders, I think, now, they don't come to me and say, well, what's your thinking here? What are you wanting us to do? I think they think I'm brave, so that, you know, I may put a short three in, and they think, oh, Ian's brave, he's ridden Murphy, he wants us to go Yahoo too. And you know, I'd much rather they came and asked me and we can discuss it and I can help, you know, at least if they know what I'm thinking, they can make their own mind up, but at least if they know what I'm looking for. But very few of the riders do actually come and speak to me, which kind of surprises me. Maybe I'm too intimidating. Maybe I'm scary.
is that something that you would do, Sam? Is it something that, you know, a lot of people think that they're able to do?
It's the first, whenever I walk courses with people, it's the first thing I tell any rider to do when they walk up to a fence is, okay, well, the first thing you're doing as you're walking up to the fence is you're thinking, what's my horse seeing and what's my horse thinking, particularly the first time you walk a course, because that you get there. It's the one time you can put yourself in your horse's mind, because they're going to be seeing it for the first time. But then I always say, what is the course designer thinking here? So that's my question that I will tell people to ask. And if I can't answer that question, I mean, I've had many a confab with Ian at Tattersall's, and he's going around in his buggy, and I want to kick him out of it and steal the buggy. But I think it's a really good thing, and to be honest, I think it's something that course designers are really generous with, is their time. So for sure, any person listening to this, any rider who's listening to this, when you're confused, or I mean, firstly, just don't walk a course flippantly thinking, yeah, red is on the right, fence 10 comes after fence 9. You know, you do think about the thought that's gone into it, because I can guarantee you that it you know, not just Ian, but every course designer out there has put an awful lot of thought into those fences, and it will help you. It'll stop you getting caught out so much. Because if you walk up to a, particularly those trickier fences, or where there's a bit of natural ground being brought into play, if you're not thinking what's the course designer thought, you'll probably get caught out.
Yeah, I think I quite agree with Sam. But the other thing is, you know, as a designer, you put the fences out there, and I it doesn't matter where the fences are. I've got to walk it, and I don't walk in feet and inches or meters or yards or whatever. I walk the distance that I think is suitable for the terrain and the horse. So I walk different distances, and you set the fences and you think, right, the horse is going to, you know, I'm sure there's a definite 4 there. And then you watch the people ride it, and some go in 3 and some go in 5 or 6. And you think, actually, I might as well just drop the fences from the sky and let people work it out. But you know, we do, the designers, we do have it. We must, I think, have it in our own mind that there is a definite 4 strides or 3 strides or whatever there. And that's what I'm looking for. the riders can, if it's a short striding horse, they can add one. If it's a Murphy, then they might take one out. But, you know, I think they have to, I have to be sure that there is a distance there that's correct, and the horse is going to be able to, if it comes in the right gear, it's going to be able to jump it in those strides.
Ian, I watched my dad's silver medal successfully pulled it off back in 1978. I watched the World Games back then, and I thought, what, my eyes were open. I would have described eventing back in the day as a bit of a survival sport. I think if you could compete, you were doing very well. And I would describe it now as very much a skilled sport. I think it's highly skilled in all three phases. I think even the technicality in the show jumping, the type of fences, you know, the way the courses are laid out. What do you, you know, when you're thinking about the test of cross country, our courses are a little bit shorter, but in some ways they're more intense, which I think ups the skill level as well. But what do you see as the key parts of the test now? What are you thinking when you're setting the course, I suppose, philosophy and things like that? And I know that can differ between course designers, but what's your take on it?
Well, I think it's not only differs between course designers, it differs between courses because the terrain dictates, you know, what you can do and what you've got to play with. You know, if you look at Tattersalls, it's on a smallish area on flattish ground, and then you go to Bramham on a huge estate with endless hills. You know, you have to be careful that you don't overdo the technical difficulty if you've got the endless terrain and ups and downs, because it mentally exhausts horses as much as anything. But I quite agree with you, the likes of Tattersalls, you know, it tends to be a short distance, but I go for maximum efforts. Otherwise, people would just gallop around. And at the likes of Tattersalls, because it's a flattish ground, I want people to open up and shorten, open up a gallop and collect the gallop and, you know, play with the striding of the horse so that you're making them open up to a combination, and then they've got to come right back to the coffin and then open up to the next one. So you're always sort of playing with that. My philosophy is that I'm very anti what I call giant arena events. So endless twisting and pulling horses around and turning. I think you can try and get a flow. I still ask the technical questions and the lines and the bending lines and everything. What I try to look for is getting a flow, and it's still thinking of old-fashioned cross-country riding from A to B. I never like to think that you're going round in circles and sort of confusing the horse in my mind. I want the horse to still think, okay, I'm going to turn here and I'm going to go in this corner and then I'm come out again. But they're always going somewhere is kind of what I'm looking for. So it goes right back to the old-fashioned point-to-point. You know, they used to do a point-to-point race from one village to the next. So it was, there was a reason and a purpose to go somewhere. And I think for me, I'd like to try and keep that in the cross-country courses, because if I'm endlessly twisting and turning and pulling them and doing a, you know, 360 some every now and again, then I don't feel the horses are getting into a flow. I think it's too much. For me, it's too much like an arena event and a show jumping course. And I want the technical difficulty brought in with the big, bold, galloping rider frighteners. It's kind of what I'm always thinking.
A lot of that turning that you're describing and that kind of arena stuff, I find it quite mentally tiring on the horses, particularly the younger ones. And it can end up, things start going a little bit backwards and I think, whereas if they can prick their ears and go from fence to fence a little bit more, I think that the challenge when you have courses like that and you know, I think at Tattersalls in June, which is, you know, naturally a flattish area, you've used the mounds really well there so that there's still transitions and gear changes, but on good ground it's hard. But I suppose that's where it's horses for courses. And if you've got a horse who's very smart in the dressage and show jumps well, but they still need to be brave. I mean, Tats has thrown up some interesting competitions. Actually, there was when you put in that new coffin, there were a lot of very flash dressage tests, and then those flashy dressage horses didn't want to go past the ditch. So it was, yeah. I enjoyed commentating on that and watching that. It's good fun.
Is that your sixth sense of humor taking over there?
Yeah, well, exactly. It was good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but I think it's, you know, the other thing you were asking about philosophy, and if it's perfect ground conditions and the horses are, riders are riding really well and horses are jumping really well, you know, I know we only want a few in the time and a clearing in the time, but everything is perfect, conditions are perfect, and people are riding well and horses jumping well, I don't really care if there's 15 or 20 get in the time, if that's a sort of one-off. But, you know, I think we have to be careful. There was a strong push a few years ago from one or two people, and they were kind of saying that they felt the cross-country time should be unobtainable. And I thought that was a really bad move, because for me, if it's unattainable, you're flogging a horse again and again and again, and you're never getting the ultimate, you're never getting inside the time. And I don't mind if there's the odd day too many get inside the time, as long as that doesn't happen too often. And I think horses and riders going well should be able to attain the time.
Yeah. And it would increase the, I suppose, the danger aspect of it. If they feel that the time isn't obtainable, it's a speed competition, isn't it? It's who's gone fastest. And actually, that's one of the things I want to ask you about, because when you were competing, you know, through 80s, 90s, through to the sport today, actually the safety aspect of it has changed massively. The courses have changed to a degree as well, and you've now got a lot of safety devices like frangible pins, like collapsible mim clips and everything like that at disposal. How does that work? How do you decide what goes where, and where does the science come into that?
I think that the answer to that, it depends who you speak to. I think, you know, right at the beginning, we had the traditional pins that the Transport Research Laboratory in London tested. And now the only time we use them is in the front of a corner, on the point of the corner and not on the wide rail. And then they moved on to reverse pins and then the MIMS clip and everything. And I think they've all got their place. And I think it depends on which designer you speak to, what question they want to put, what type of device they want to put at different places. I'm kind of very anti people losing a competition because a pin broke. If they give it a clout and a pin breaks, and it, you know, not necessarily going to have been a fall. You watch some horses that plow through a solid fence that's not frangible and still stand. I kind of mixed feelings about the frangible devices. I think it's important that we try and get rid of the horrible accidents. But the likes of Bramham last year, I used the MIMS clip and we put them on a vertical post and we chopped the post in half and used the clips horizontally rather vertically rather than horizontally. And I had 15 clips went and I was in a complete rage. And I wrote to the FEI because as far as I could see, and this is no real criticism to the company, but I think they self-assessed the situation. And now I believe there's a certain way of cutting the rail and connecting the device. So I think it's good. I think it's a very positive step, the fact that the posts can be chopped and the posts fall. So if a rail falls, you're not left with an upright. I think that's really good. When we did it at Bramham last year, I don't think we had the information and all these clips went. To be fair, there was probably about half a dozen riders that were unlucky, but there was also about 10 riders that the clips did save them having a fall. So, but it was too many mistakes or too many clips going, from my opinion. I was always tempted to say that I didn't think they should get penalties, but you know, a few years ago when we had that safety seminar at Tattersall's and Andrew Nicholson spoke and he said, riders get braver, let's take a little bit more risk, in his opinion, to take more risk when there's a frangible device there. So if that is the case, then people deserve the 11 penalties. But I kind of feel we're getting into show jumping territory if we're getting penalties for clip breaking.
Well, it sort of goes with the move of the times, really, doesn't it? I mean, we've seen it with the Grand National. What is acceptable and what's not? I think we all agree. No one likes to see a pin go when, you know, everyone standing there looking thinks, oh, okay, that didn't need to go. No one wants to see the penalties go through all that. But I think it is. I think that's what should be worked on. Because I don't think that mistakes and failures should be punishable by, you know, serious life changing injury. We try and avoid that. And I actually think it's an interesting educational and learning tool in that the amount of times I've seen people ride a fence, particularly a fence like a sunken road or an old fashioned coffin fence, where the course designer has asked for a gear change and a rebalancing of the horse to come from a gallop back to a much more punchier canter and get the horse up his forehand and sitting on his bum a bit. And there's been no attempt made by the rider to do that. And they fly in and they make him, and you just think, hang on, you need to learn somehow. I've seen you watching people. It's not easy for you to watch when people make mistakes on the course. You don't want anyone to fall off. You don't really want that to be the punishment. So I think that's particularly at the lower levels, that's where I think it can actually be educational. Yes, absolutely. It's not show jumping, but they can be a positive thing if they're, you know, once they're activating in the right way. Yeah. So that's good.
No, I think I totally agree. If they're activating correctly, I think they are very positive. And I think, that's when I try to think of what device I'm going to use for what type of fences, because there's no doubt some give easier than others. Like for me, if I'm going into a coffin, if I've got a MIMS clip, then a horse can break that MIMS clip with its back feet slowing it down. Whereas if it's a reverse pin, it's got a little bit more resistance. So, you know, that sort of attitude is what I'm always thinking about. So I want to get the right device for the horses and the riders to make it safer, but also not make it a show jumping competition.
I think as well, we'll see. I mean, we've seen the developments in the last few years of fences and safety devices that have changed. With the research that's ongoing, you would hope that they'll only be refined more and that there will be more sort of research available and there'll be better products available to use to enhance the safety of it. In terms of sort of designing a fence as such, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier in walking the course and asking for, you know, you can go back and ask the course designer how he wanted or she wanted you to jump that fence. Black flags, so alternative options. You know, you go up to a complex, it might be the lake at Badminton or it could be the coffin combination that we've talked about, Bramah, anywhere like that. You've got your direct route. But actually, as a course designer, you're then also thinking of those less experienced horses, of people that might be have lost their confidence a little bit earlier on in the course. And how do you kind of design those different options? Because some of them, you know, there's a lot of rules to adhere to of you can do this, but you can't do that. It's quite a complex process, I would imagine.
It is. And frequently, I have to confess that I've put an alternative in and then the technical delegate comes along and said, well, you can't do that because they're going to get 20 penalties. And I swear a lot at everybody and then I have to work it out and get it right. I put alternatives in. I think there should always be an alternative if something is technically difficult or something is very demanding, very big, bold, galloping, big jumping. Because I don't think people should be forced to do these things. On the other hand, if you're going to give them an alternative, it's either got to be very, very time-consuming or a softer version of the... It's very difficult to do a softer version of a coffin. So you have to do a time-consuming, different combination. But in the ideal world, an alternative should be a softer version of the direct route, but it's just not always financially or physically possible to do that.
Ian, you've hopefully going to have your 5-star debut this year. What are the ambitions for you personally? Are there things that you would you like the badminton job, the burley job, Olympics, Worlds?
It's quite interesting because when I started, I had no ambition to do. When I started designing, I was just enjoying it, and you know it picks up, and then it went quite well. So then I started to think, oh yeah, I'd love badminton or I'd love burley, and actually, I think as I get older, I have no less enthusiasm for the job. In fact, I'm probably more committed and more determined to get it right. But I probably haven't really got the ambition to do badminton or burley. I've not been offered either of them, which probably does make a difference. But I'm really happy with Tattersalls and Bramham, and I've got this 5-star in America, and you know there's a potential of taking over Poe as well. So I'm just happy with my lot, and as long as I'm enjoying the courses and the events, and the riders are happy, then you know I'm happy. If an Olympics came along, or badminton came along, would I jump at it? I don't know. It depends on what else was going on at that time. And by the time the next Olympics come round, I'll be 70. I'm sort of getting at the end of my career. You know, and I haven't got much left to go. So I think it's exciting to do an Olympics, but it's kind of got its limitations because it's not a 5-star. And the kudos of doing an Olympics, yeah, it's great. But in many ways, I'm deliriously happy with what I've got. I really, really enjoy it. And I said to at Tattersalls and Bramham every year, I say, you know, you must tell me when you want to replace me and get someone else. And Nick Lane Fox said to me last year, well, how old are you and how many years have you got left? And I said, well, if I go till I'm 72, I said, basically, I've got 7 years left. And he said, oh, that's good. That saves me looking for another designer for 7 years then, which is a lovely attitude. What I don't want to be is be there and get sort of have run out of ideas and people get bored of the course. So if that was happening, I'd hope somebody would come along and say, you know, either sharp enough or get out. I'm old enough and ugly enough that I can take that sort of direct honesty. And if it's time to stop, then it's time to stop. At the moment, I'm loving it and enjoying it. And as long as those riders are going to come and jump my courses, you know, I'd love to keep going a bit longer.
Is there anything that you would tweak that you would kind of? I suppose we're getting into rules and things like that. But I mean, one thing I've noticed is that as our horses have and the standard of dressage has gone up and the scores have gotten a bit lower, the time penalties are creeping back up at 5-star. So I think, generally I think riders are starting to make a bit of a U-turn and keep their eyes open for something that's a bit more of a natural galloper compared to some of the horses we've had. But would you go longer or would you have more jumping efforts? You know, is there anything that you'd like to throw in there? Or do you think it's in pretty good shape and it's, you know, bang on working?
I think we have to be careful. If you're doing 5-star, I know there's a strong push to try and disregard the jumping efforts. Say, for example, the ditch of a coffin, or that doesn't get counted as a jumping effort, or a simple step down doesn't get counted as a jumping effort. But or other people are saying, well, if we can get 10% leeway, so you've got 40 jumps, so you've got 4 extra you could play with. I think we have to be careful that we're not just continuously trying to make it tougher and more difficult to achieve. I think, again, I go back to the terrain. If it's a gallopy flat course, then I don't think it would do any harm to have a couple of extra jumping efforts to help slow the riders down and make them play with the gears of the horse. But I don't think there's much wrong with what we've got. And, you know, the 5-stars at the moment, there's usually only 2 or 3 get inside the time. And I think that's about right. That makes it a good competition, and it's attainable, and it's something to strive for.
And it keeps things moving. Can I ask you, just before we let you go, Some top tips. So it could be people walking the course. It could be them interested in getting into course design. It could be anything from cross-country riding. You've ridden at the highest level. You design at the highest level. What are the sort of pieces of wisdom that you would most like to tell people that pay attention to this or try this? Now's a chance to get a couple of messages across.
I think the two things, and one we've covered already, I do wish riders would come and either ask me to walk the course or ask me about fences. I'm not going to snap bite at their heads off. I'm there to help. Occasionally when I walk a course and I see people walking a line and I think, oh my God, you know, that's really bad. And I used to step back and say nothing and think, well, you know, they must know what they're doing or they know their horse. And now I'm afraid I just wade in and I say, have you thought about this? And, you know, this is another possibility. So, you know, I do wish people would come and discuss it more. The other thing is, yeah, that sometimes, you know, I don't mean to generalize in this, but I think we all as competitive people can be a little bit arrogant. And I'm, you know, probably I was one of the worst when I was competing. But it doesn't matter how good you are and how brilliant the horse is. None of us is ever going to know everything about horses and the sport. And so we're all learning. And I think people have to think about that more and more as they're competing. You know, it's not God-given right that they can go fast inside the time and clear cross country. They've got to listen to other people and pick brains and discuss things and discuss amongst themselves. I think the sport's always been really good at helping each other. And I think people have to make more use of that.
Yeah,
it's good advice. Keep learning.
Very good advice.
Keep learning. Yeah.
And that stands everybody in good stead. So listeners, there you go. Two very, very good pieces of advice. Take them on board. We hope they're useful. And we hope you've enjoyed this little delve into cross-country course design as much as Sam and I have. Ian, thank you. It has been fascinating.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I hope I haven't been too intense.
No. Honestly, it's a topic of conversation that I think we could all go into in great, great, great detail. And we can only sort of scratch the surface on this podcast because it is fascinating. And there are so many different opinions and so many different options and ways of doing things. And ultimately, you want to set a fair, appropriate test and get everybody home safely. So thank you very much. We're going to look forward to following your courses, hopefully in 2020, if not 2021. And of course, the 5-star at Fairhill. Stay safe and thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sam, thank you. We'll be back very soon with another episode of the EquiRatings Eventing Podcast. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to the EquiRatings Eventing Podcast. This podcast is available for free on iTunes, Spotify, Podcast Addict, or wherever you usually listen to your podcasts. Make sure you subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. Find us at eventingpodcast.com or search Eventing Podcast on social media.